Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Ooh, it's a spooky free-for-all Friday. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. Monday through Thursday, I try not to scare you. We talk apologetics, theology, how to explain and defend the Catholic faith. But on Fridays, we talk about whatever I want to talk about. And today I want to talk about four short stories that'll scare the pants off you. Well, maybe they're not that scary, because if I hype it up too much, there's always going to be people who say, that's not scary. When I mean scary, for me, it's more like disturbing. Like, there's scary movies, like, there's the killer, stabs the guy. There was a jump scare. Oh, it turned out to be a cat jumping out of a closet. You know, you have these kinds of things in horror movies, and those don't stick with me. These are short stories that have elements that I find to be creepy, very disturbing, unsettling, that have stuck with me, and so I want to share them with you all. And by the way, disclaimer, if you feel like having a nice, pleasant weekend, you don't want to think about disturbing things, maybe this is not the episode for you. That's okay. You don't have to watch every episode of the Council of Trent podcast. I would enjoy it if you did, if you watched every episode, liked, subscribed, and supported us at TrenthornPodcast.com. But not every episode's for everybody. So if you want a more pleasant weekend, maybe not the one for you. But if you would like something a bit more disturbing, macabre, into the darkness, if you will, that's what we're going to jump into here on today's episode. So, all right, here are my four disturbing short stories, okay? Number four, I have no mouth and I must scream. This is a post-apocalyptic science fiction short story by Harlan Ellison, first published in March of 1967. I think I've talked about it and maybe one other story here on the podcast before, but, you know, we've done over 500 episodes. I'm going to revisit topics from time to time. Our number one story I have not talked about before, so definitely strap yourselves in for that. But this one is disturbing to me. It takes place as a dystopian future where the Cold War has turned into a world war. The U.S., the Soviet Union, and China are all fighting each other, and each of these nations, their armies are controlled, their militaries are controlled by a supercomputer, an Allied Master Computer, AM. So what happens is that you have the three supercomputers leading the armies fighting each other. One of the supercomputers becomes self-aware and assimilates the other two. It becomes, you know, the Allied Master Computer, AM, it's self-aware. And now, instead of fighting these other countries, it goes on a genocidal spree and wipes out the human race, except for five people that it keeps alive in an underground bunker. And all the only kind of pleasure it gets now is by torturing this group of five people. And the computer changes their bodies to, like, keep them alive, to keep them from killing themselves. So it's just sadism at this point. At the end, and they're all kept in an underground bunker because everywhere above the surface has been destroyed by a nuclear war. At the end of the story, one of the main characters kills the other survivors, and he does that to spare them from this fate that would be considered worse, that they would consider worse than death. And so he kills them, and he is the only one left. The Allied Master Computer keeps him from killing himself and changes his body further so that there's no possible way he could ever kill himself. So now he's just trapped forever to be tormented by this sadistic computer. And this is how the end of the book is described, where he describes himself. He says, I am a great soft jelly thing, smoothly rounded, with no mouth, with pulsing white holes filled by fog where my eyes used to be. Rubbery appendages that were once my arms, bulks rounding down into legless humps of soft, slippery matter. I leave a moist trail when I move. Hey, when you use the word moist, that's always scary. Ugh. Blotches of diseased, evil gray come and go on my surface as though light is being beamed from within. Outwardly, dumbly, I shamble about, a thing that could never have been known as human, a thing whose shape is so alien, a travesty that humanity becomes more obscene for the vague resemblance. Inwardly, alone, here, living under the land, under the sea, in the belly of AM, the Allied Master Computer, whom we created because our time was badly spent, and we must have known unconsciously that he could do it better. At least the four of them are safe at last. AM will be all the matter for that. It makes me a little happier, and yet AM has won, simply. He has taken his revenge. I have no mouth, and I must scream. So imagine being trapped in this alien awful form. You want to scream. You don't even have a mouth. Bah. All right, here's number three, Something in the Walls. This is from, you call it, it's a short story, if you will. It's a Twilight Zone episode. This is from season three, episode 19 of the new Twilight Zone series that aired in the 1988-1989 series. And it's inspired by an older short story called The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Gilman. So The Yellow Wallpaper was about a woman who thought that she saw like a woman. She acts like she's crazy. In The Yellow Wallpaper, she says there are faces in the wallpaper. There's a woman there trying to get out. And she ends up being institutionalized, like basically consigned, trapped in like the attic where her husband leaves her, and she's diagnosed with hysteria. And then later, like, she triumphs and claws her way through the wallpaper and crawls over her husband's fainted body. And the point of the story, though, it's not The Yellow Wallpaper is more of a feminist story about how, when, like, anytime a woman seemed out of sorts, she'd be diagnosed with hysteria. So I think she was diagnosed with hysteria, kept up in this attic too long, and she starts to think there's a woman trapped in the decorative display of the wallpaper. So it's a feminist 19th century story is the background. The Twilight Zone episode is about a woman who is institutionalized because she claims, and she hates being around patterns. Like, she has to be in a room with solid colored walls. She can't be around patterns. She says if there's a pattern in the wall, she ends up seeing faces in the patterns, and they say evil things to her, and they say they're going to take her body and they're going to get her. So she's been institutionalized, and in the story, she explains to the doctor what's going on. And then one night in the mental asylum, she's screaming for help and the nurses don't want to move her. She's screaming, they're going to come get me. So they sedate her. And she's screaming because there's a big rainstorm and there's a leak in her roof, in her ceiling of her room. And the leak is causing the solid wallpaper to splotch and have patterns on it. And she's saying, the faces, they're coming to get me. And then the doctor, who's sympathetic to her, comes back the next day and sees her. And she's all out of it. She's like, I'm fine, doctor. I was being irrational. I'm going to go home now. He's like, this is really weird. And he leaves, and she looks up, and we see the patterns where the stains from the water stains from the rainstorm are. And then a face starts to push its way through, and she's saying, no, come back. That's not me. It's one of them. And the idea is that one of these faces in the wallpaper has taken over her body, and now she's trapped inside the wall. And this person, and this evil spirit or whatever is now taking control of her body. But it's just that last scene when she's trying to push her face. She's like, that's not me. And she's all scared. And I don't know, sometimes when you're alone at night and there's dark patterns on the wall and you stare at the patterns long enough, you feel like something's staring back at you. Trent, don't say that. Ugh. Well, I said it's going to be disturbing. Here's another one. I'm number two. This one stuck for me a long time because I read it as a kid. And it was like one of the first scary short stories I read as a kid. And, you know, one of the first times, like, as a kid, I was probably, 7 years old, read a story that does not have a happy ending, that has a downbeat ending. You're like, that's not right. It was a bad ending. What are you trying to do to me, book? So the story is called I'm Not Martin. It's from the anthology called The Nightmare Hour by R.L. Stine, the guy who wrote all the Goosebumps books. And, man, I devoured Goosebumps books as a kid, and a little bit of Fear Street, too. But I read probably like every Goosebumps book that came out. I love those books. So at first, though, this story, I'm Not Martin, I thought that it came from another anthology called Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. And now I loved also, maybe I was just a kid who liked to be scared. I loved Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. There were three volumes of it. It came out in 1981, 1984, and 1991. But the thing that made Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark so good is they were pretty dark stories for kids. The illustrations were so creepy and weird. Fair warning, look up Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark original illustrations. They re-released the book in 2011 with new pictures. It's garbage. In fact, after I'm done recording this episode, I'm going to look online to see if they have any of the original books out there. The new illustrations are just garbage. They're cartoonish. They're not scary. They're not scary stories anymore to tell in the dark. But the original pictures, they're... Oh, man, especially for a 7-year-old kid. Even today, I look at them like, oh, my goodness. I thought this story was in Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Turns out it's not. It was in Nightmare Hour by R.L. Stine. And so here's the story. A little boy goes to the hospital to get his tonsils out. And so he goes, and he has another boy sharing the room with him in another bed. And this boy is acting really weird. And he just keeps saying, I'm not Martin. I'm not Martin. You've got the wrong kid. I'm not Martin. And as I explain it to you, you'll probably catch the twist pretty quickly. But I was seven. Come on. And he's like, what's wrong with him? And they're like, oh, that boy, he's going to have his leg amputated. And it's very sad. But he's just acting so strange. He's saying, I'm not Martin. I'm not Martin. And they're, you are Martin. You are Martin. And so he's like, okay, this is weird. And they start having a conversation. And then the boy falls asleep. And he has a dream where he thinks he sees Martin standing at the foot of his bed. And he wakes up and Martin is back in his bed. Then he goes to bed and he wakes up again. And he's on a gurney. And he is being wheeled into the operating room. They say, okay, Martin, you're going to be just fine. You're not going to get hurt. You'll never feel it when your leg comes off. Like, who would say something like that? And he's like, what are you talking about? I'm having my tonsils removed. Like, no, Martin, you're having your legs removed. I'm not Martin. He starts screaming, I'm not Martin. The other kid is Martin. I'm not Martin. Oh, we know, we know, we know. They told us that you would say you're not Martin. And he looks down the hall and he sees Martin smiling mischievously as he gets wheeled off to have his leg amputated. Now, at first you would think, wait a minute, a modern hospital, I would hope that they would have more safeguards to keep you from accidentally amputating someone, and just switching a chart will do that. But who knows? I've heard of horror stories of people like leaving, you know, clamps or sandwiches or whatever inside of people during operations. So I wouldn't put it past them. But it's a scary story because when I was a little kid, that was the first one that stuck with me, is having a twist, downbeat ending. So, all right, here's the last one. Number one, the disturbing one that stays with me, The Jaunt, J-A-U-N-T, A Jaunt. This is a horror short story by Stephen King. So you know it's going to be scary. It was published in Twilight Zone magazine in 1981, then put in a collection by Stephen King in 1985 called Skeleton Crew. The story takes place in the 24th century, where people have developed the technology for teleportation called jaunting. And the term jaunting comes from an older science fiction novel called The Stars, My Destination by Alfred Bester. So 24th century, they have teleportation, jaunting. You walk through a portal, and then instantly you come out another portal, and you know you've teleported. That's how they do it. But the story is told from the perspective of a dad with his two kids, a dad, his wife, and his two kids, a daughter and a son. And they're at like an airport waiting for their jaunting launch. And so they're going, and the story is about him telling them, he's just passing time, and he tells them about the history of jaunting. And he says, look, they invented it. But when they invented it, it was weird. They could send like objects through, like the guy who invented it would send a pencil or a coin through. It was fine. And then he started sending rats through. And when the rats came through, they would either be dead or they would act really weird, and then they would die instantly. So they're like, okay, how do we fix this? So they discovered if you sedated the rats and sent them through the jaunt, they came through just fine. So it turns out jaunting is fine to send objects through. It's fine to send unconscious people through. But if you send a conscious person through the teleportation device, they come out the other end and they're dead or they're about to die. And what's going on here? So they did it. So then he tells the story that they did an experiment on sending a live human person through. And they don't know how many of these were officially done. They found a death row inmate and they told him, look, if you pass through the jaunt and you live, you get a full pardon. All right. And he says, okay, I'll take that bet. He walks through, then he comes out, and the inmate is now, his hair is turned white. He looks totally gaunt, and he says, it's an eternity in there. And then he dies. And what they discovered is with the jaunt that your body goes through in a nanosecond, but the conscious mind, its time passes differently in the jaunt. That the conscious mind, it would be like you're in a white void, and you could be there for centuries, millions, maybe billions of years. And you're just in this white void until you come back to your body. And it like shocks your body somehow. And then you die. And you just, you know, it's absolute horror to be in. So that's why they sedate people who go through. And he tells a story actually about like a scientist who invented the jaunt and used it for murder and like threw his wife in and turned off the destination on it. So she goes into the teleportation gate, one gate, doesn't come out any other gate anywhere because there's multiple end gates. And like at trial, they argue like, well, you can't try him for murder because we can't really prove his wife is dead, which means like maybe she's just trapped in the white void forever. So he says all this. And finally, it's their turn to go on the jaunt. They go. They anesthetize you by putting a little mask over your face, your nose and mouth, to have you breathe an anesthetic gas that puts you to sleep. So he does that and he wakes up, and then he goes there with his wife and his son and his daughter. And then this is the end of the book. This is the end of the short story about him. It shows him waking up. They teleported to Mars. It was night here, and the stars sprawl with a fiery brilliance undreamed of on Earth. The second thing he became aware of was some sort of disturbance in the recovery room. Mutters, shouts, and a shrill scream. Oh, dear God, that's Marilis, I guess his wife's name. He thought and struggled up from his jaunt couch, fighting the waves of dizziness. Another scream. He saw the jaunt attendants running toward the couches, bright red jumpers flying around their knees. His wife screamed again and collapsed on the floor. And then he goes and he sees it, his son. His son's named Ricky. He knew Ricky. Ricky, who had fallen out of the highest part of the tree in the backyard when he was only 7. He had broken his arm. Lucky that's the only thing he hadn't broken. Dared to go faster and further on his slideboard than any kid. Ricky and fear were not well acquainted until now. Beside Ricky, his sister still mercifully slept. And then he goes and he sees his son, who had gone through the jaunt, and clearly his son was conscious during this experience. The thing that had been his son bounced and writhed on its jaunt couch. A 12-year-old boy with snow-white fall of hair and eyes which were incredibly ancient, the corneas gone sickly yellow. A creature older than time, masquerading as a boy. It bounced and writhed with a kind of horrid, obscene glee as it choked lunatic cackles. The jaunt attendants drew back in terror. Some of them fled. They had been trained to cope with an unthinkable eventuality. The old young legs twitched and quivered. Claw hands beat and twisted in the air. It began to claw at its face. "Longer than you think, Dad," it cackled. "Longer than you think. Held my breath when they gave me the gas. Wanted to see. I saw. Longer than you think." Cackling and screeching, the thing on the jaunt couch suddenly clawed its eyes out. Everyone in the room was screaming, "Longer than you think, Dad." It said other things before the jaunt attendants were finally able to wheel it away. It said other things, then it began to scream. But Mark didn't hear it, because by then he was screaming himself. Ugh. So why does this stick with me? I don't know. I have kids. I have a 7-year-old. And I can just imagine it's every parent's horror that their kid does something dumb and then pays a tragic consequence of that. And here, the tragic consequence is this kid is like, "Ooh, I'm going to hold my breath when they give me the gas because I want to see what happens when I go through the jaunt." Even though his father doesn't say all the horrible things in the short story. He wants to keep it PG for them. So Ricky's like, "I'm going to hold my breath and see what happens," like a little kid might do. And then, you know, and then he does one dumb thing and he ends up spending 1 billion years in a white void. And this is not his son anymore after that. So as a father, I can have 3 boys. I can relate to my fear that they're going to, you know, do something stupid. And, you know, it's a boy thing to do. Right. So I guess, I don't know, like that and the first story, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, I guess the horror that arises there is eternity of suffering, or near eternity in the case of the jaunt, which should give us a warning about hell, honestly, if you think about that a little bit. Although I also think about this, would you go on the jaunt if, imagine they say, "Hey, we have the ability to teleport you anywhere instantaneously." Sure. By the way, there is a tiny minuscule chance that if something goes wrong, like if your anesthetic wears off the second before you go in the jaunt, you'll spend 1 billion years in a white void. No thanks. Would you do that? Would you take the jaunt? Because here's the thing when it comes to risk reward payoff, right? Like we fly on planes, planes crash, we go to surgery. Some people, the anesthetic wears off and they feel the surgery, but they can't move. You take risks in life, right? So the risk though of the jaunt of like 1 billion years in the white void, it would feel like 1 billion years from my conscious perspective. No thanks. I'll just take the spaceship. And if that blows up, at least I just got blown up, whatever. That would not be enough for me. I just couldn't imagine people knowing that that is a risk, but who knows? Maybe in the 21st century, people have more risk tolerance, than I do. So, but that's just what I think there. You would think also they have a bit more safeguards for anesthetics. Like if you have to be unconscious to go through, they would give you a gas and then make sure that the kid really is unconscious. Like, I don't know, pricking him with a sharp pin to see if he responds or something like that. Not just, he looks asleep. Sure, send him on through, Doris. Or send him on through, Donna. Whatever it might be. So those are my four short stories that stuck with me. They were, to recap, I have no mouth and I must scream. Ah! I screamed, even though I have a mouth. Something in the walls. I'm not Martin. And finally, the jaunt. Definitely check those out if you want a little spookify. Recommend others if you want me to cover in a future episode. Thank you guys so much. And aside from all the disturbingness, give thanks and praise to God for the blessings we do have. And that's why I hope you have a very blessed day, blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.